This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is a podcast that I've very much been looking forward to because we've been anxiously awaiting the publication and release of a new book entitled Master Your Diabetes, A Comprehensive Integrative Approach for Both Type 1 and Type 2 Diabetes. And with me today is the author. She's Dr. Mona Morstein. And we've interviewed her before here on Intelligent Medicine on the subject of diabetes, but I wanted to bring her back on because she's just done such a magnificent job in her new book that I wanted to share some of the information with you and encourage you, if you or a loved one suffers from diabetes, this is the definitive guide both to conventional care. She's done a great job on the conventional side, but also on the natural medicine side. She is ideally suited to write such a book. She's been a naturopathic doctor for 24 years. In fact, she's taught at the Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine. Now she's in private practice. She's an expert not only on diabetes, but on obesity, hormonal conditions, and she has lectured internationally. She's been on TV, so she's eminently suited to help us deal with this problem. So it's a pleasure having you back again on Intelligent Medicine. Mona, congratulations.
Thank you, Ron. That's really very kind of you. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I really consider you the go-to person. You're very authoritative on this. And I think, you know, what's really excellent about the book is that you don't just talk about natural approaches, but you really seem to have perfectly integrated the conventional approaches to diabetes, and you review them critically, you know, things that work, things that might potentially be useless or harmful or dangerous. And then you talk about the natural approach. So I really would recommend this book to enlightened lay people, patients with diabetes or family members, but also to medical professionals, both on the holistic side and on the conventional side. I think it's an eminently sensible book for anyone involved in this field to be well acquainted with. So great.
Well, thanks for saying that, because with my editor, you know, we really tried to get that middle gray zone where it would be informative but not overwhelming for lay people or patients of diabetes, but it would also be a great clinical reference for medical practitioners. So I'm delighted that you seem to think we really tagged that middle zone.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, in reading it, I learned some stuff, and this is a field that I'm very well acquainted with. So first of all, frame the issue for us. You know, why so prevalent? I mean, it's a huge problem, perhaps maybe the major theme among degenerative diseases that threaten to sink our medical system in the U.S.
Well, it is true. If we're looking at recent statistics, 52% of Americans are either pre-diabetic or diabetic. I mean, that's crazy. One out of every four senior over 65 is a diabetic patient. Type 1, the autoimmune disease of diabetes, is also increasing worldwide, not just the type 2. So we have, and obesity right now, not overweight, but 40% of Americans are obese. So if we're looking at, there's so many factors that go into the development of diabetes, right? Such, obviously, becoming overweight from maybe poor diet choices or too much food, not enough exercise, lack of supplementation and nutrient deficiency, environmental toxins, healing the gut microbiome. There's, I mean, when we look at all of these factors coming together, we can see why here in this country and worldwide, it is a crisis.
Well, absolutely. And let's distinguish among the different types of diabetes.
Sure.
I mean, classically, we divided diabetes into type 1 versus type 2, but diabetes seems to occur along a spectrum, and there are actually some intermediate
sure.
forms that maybe people are less aware of. But help us distinguish among the main types.
Well, you know, the classic type 1 we generally term as pediatric, although in medicine, pediatric ends at age 18. Type 1 pediatric goes well into the 20s. We can also get type 1 then later in life from, say, in general, ages 35 to 60, although it can be outside those ages. But a lot of type 1 can occur in adults, and many of them are misdiagnosed as having type 2. That's called latent autoimmune diabetes of the adult, and may not come on as strikingly obvious as pediatric type 1, but it's still driven by the same autoimmune situation. We have type 2, which is around 90 to 95% of people with diabetes have that abdominal fat, and therefore type 2 diabetes. But there are lean type 2 diabetes. Generally, I see these patients who have a big history of diabetes and then just got off on the diet really badly, got into drinking a lot of, you know, sugary drinks, and even though they didn't gain the weight, it turned their genes on. So we have a we have a small percentage of type 2s that are lean. And then there is we have MODY, mature onset diabetes of youth, which is really just a genetic screw up, like you make insulin, but your body can't secrete it, or you can secrete
so that's, that
it.
So that doesn't mean your pancreas has shut down, as in type 1 diabetes.
No, it means you make it. It's just that the machinery to get it out, or the machinery to have it, you know, signal your cells doesn't work so good. And then last, you know, we've got for example gestational diabetes, and which is really just type 2 during pregnancy, and you know, so these are the main groupings.
Right. The end result of a prolonged history of what's called type 2 or non-insulin dependent diabetes is that it may morph into type 1 diabetes, where you ultimately require insulin. But that's controversial too, because, you know, both of us have seen patients who've come to us on insulin. Maybe they didn't really need it. They just needed the right kind of nutritional support. And
it's true, but remember, just to clarify terms, if you'll allow me.
Sure.
No type 2 becomes type 1.
Right.
What we have is type 2, if they're under conventional care and just not being told what to eat, or getting told to eat a high-carb, low-fat diet, and then they're just getting medication 1 and medication 2, it's not going to control it. In fact, 77% of people have A1Cs over 6, and almost about 43% of people have A1Cs over 7. This is not good. This will cause damage. And so part of this damage is to the pancreas. And so these people don't develop an autoimmune disease, but their high blood sugars over years just damages their pancreas, so that they need insulin. So we actually no longer use the terms, you know, insulin dependent and non-insulin dependent, just because we have so many people with diabetes so poorly cared for. Whether they're poorly cared for or they're just not compliant, they're refusing to, you know, make changes, or, you know, they can wind up needing insulin because they don't make it anymore.
And just by way of definition, you mentioned the hemoglobin A1C. That's a very important test for gauging your progress towards diabetes or towards resolution with natural approaches.
Right. And so the A1C is a 3-month marker of, on average, where has your blood sugar been? Now, it has some flaws that if you have a great deal of low blood sugar episodes, it can be dragged artificially down and make it look like you're doing better than you are. But in general, the problem is that the American Diabetes Association says the A1C should be at 7 or less if we're not having a lot of hypoglycemic episodes. Mm. And the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinologists say, well, you know, it should be at 6.5 or less if we're not having too much hypoglycemia. Right. Because remember, if you're just using medications, it's going to cause in oftentimes some hypoglycemia. But we know from science that an A1C over 5.5 is causing damage to the human body.
However, and you point this out very nicely in the book, sometimes by aggressively lowering blood sugar with medication, we don't necessarily prolong patients' lives. And that's why they've sort of backed off on aggressive management to get the hemoglobin A1C lower. But
yes.
I guess another way of saying that, it's not how low you go, it's how you get there.
Right, because, you know, that was the ACCORD study where, you know, there are, it's, you know, it's interesting. With type 2 diabetes, there's only one drug that actually is designed to treat the cause of the disease, which is insulin resistance, and those are TZDs. Mm-hmm. And since this ACCORD study, they're off the market in Europe, and even though we can prescribe them now, here in the States, almost no one does. But those drugs, sulfonylureas, insulin, these cause weight gain, water retention, they can aggravate congestive heart failure. And so I actually have patients now reporting to me that, you know, when they go to their doc
and their
TZDs A1C
would be
five,
drugs like Avandia, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, Avandia and Actos, I'm
right,
sorry.
But they're associated with a lot of side effects that are pretty scary.
Well, a lot of these are associated with side effects, but they're told by their endocrinologists, your A1C is 5.9, that's not good. You shouldn't have it less than 6.5, so eat more carbs.
Ay, ay, ay.
Literally, people are told that.
Bad messaging, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you apropos of diet, you have come under the influence of a guy familiar to me because I went to med school with him. He's Dr. Richard Bernstein, who practices.
Oh, you did?
Actually, he was in my med school class. I was a little older med student because I took a couple of years off, but he was a much older medical student. I think
yes.
he was about 40 when he went to medical school because
he'd
already had a career
40,
in.
Yeah,
he had a career in designing the fingerstick devices, the glucometers. And so he was distinguished as an engineer, and he himself is a type 1 diabetic. And he's originated an approach to diabetes that has influenced you, correct?
Yes. I actually, when I wanted to get serious with diabetes, I actually called his office up and I flew out and spent a week with him, you know, all day long, seeing him, you know, work and having a lot of my questions answered. And
and
he was
probably checking his own blood sugar 11 times during the day because that's what he does.
Yeah, he does. And, you know, I can't say honestly right now I agree with his idea. It always has to be 83. But he is very, and, you know, he would inject insulin if it went to 92, you know.
Mm.
So he was very strict with his, with his sugar regulation.
But he did for patients who are able to comply with such a challenging regimen of diet, exercise, and frequent blood sugar checking and injections, he's very successful at managing type 1 diabetes, and he's a testimony himself to the efficacy of it because he's several years older than I am, and he's active and practicing, and that's actually kind of an outlier for people with type 1 diabetes who suffer a lot of side effects from that condition.
You know, absolutely. His foundational message of a low-carb diet specific for diabetes and his masterful understanding of needing to inject insulin as well for protein instead of just carbs, which in conventional care to this day is still the directions. This is where, you know, when we cover proteins as well.
Because protein can go to sugar in diabetes.
Absolutely. Well, it goes to sugar in everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not covering it, and, you know, and in conventional care, they're never including protein mm-hmm. into their calculations.
Interesting insight, because if you go on a very high protein diet, very low carb diet, and you still, as a type 1 diabetic, for processing that protein properly, for helping it build muscle and preventing it from entering the bloodstream as sugar, causing blood sugar to spike, insulin plays a role. That's interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'll have patients say, oh, you know, I can't eat protein because that really raises my blood sugar. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I have everybody do a diet, and glucose graph, and when they're and you know, they're not injecting for it. So, yes, they're thinking that they can't eat protein, but they're just not covering it. Mm-hmm. And so he was brilliant in that regard. And in my book, I do credit him when I'm discussing, you know, how to properly inject insulin for protein, because it comes right from his directions.
Well, you know, I live in New York City, and I had the opportunity to go to an exhibit at the Historical Society of New York on the origins of insulin. And there's a guy named Banting who developed that.
Yeah, and 1922. Yeah.
But prior to that, the only thing they had available for diabetics was an ultra low carb diet. And there were actually journals of some of the young kids who learned to journal virtually every meal that they ate, and they were placed on ultra low carb diets in an effort to manage it with diet alone. Now, you can't do that with type 1 diabetes. It helps. It may slow the progression of the disease, but it's not entirely effective. But in type 2 diabetes, it is ultra potent in terms of not just optimizing blood sugar, but sometimes completely normalizing the situation. So talk to us about that diet.
Well, it's interesting. You know, that original low-carb doc was Elliot Joslin, and Joslin Clinic in Boston. Yeah, is still, but they've, you know, of course, gone away from that now and are into the typical medications. But, you know, the low-carb, look, if we're going to say, can you give me a one-sentence definition of diabetes? Absolutely. It's the fact that these patients have lost the metabolic capacity to process carbohydrates, whether they don't make insulin to do it or whether they make insulin, but their cells no longer respond to its signals, which is insulin resistance. If you can't handle metabolically the, you know, the ingestion of carbs, you've got to knock those down.
But of course, that view is very much at variance with what the ADA, the American Diabetes Association, has been putting out over the years. They've modified their stance a little bit, but they still talk about, you know, kind of high fiber, you know, carbohydrate laden diets. And they just say, well, take enough medication to cover the, you know, to cover the blood sugar that's engendered by your food.
It's true. And certainly with type 1 kids, they're told to eat what they want and cover it with insulin, which never works, which gives the term brittle, you know, its existence, because no child ever has to be brittle. It's not that hard to control type 1 in kids if they're not eating a high-carb diet. You know, the fact of the matter is that people just died of, you know, diabetes before Banting and Best in Toronto discovered insulin, and then we started injecting insulin, and they survived the diabetes up until they died from cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. And cardiovascular disease is still the number one reason of death of diabetic patients today. Mm-hmm. And when they did autopsies, they saw that their blood vessels were full of cholesterol and fat. So in the 70s, you know, the ADA is like, oh, you know, these people have to have low fat and high carbs. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, the paradigm shift of what is causing cardiovascular disease has so changed in science, but not for the ADA, which even though in their 2013 guidelines first mentioned that some docs may be doing a low-carb diet, their own website still advocates at least 130 grams a day.
Mm-hmm. And the problem might be insulin itself, and that's a rationale for trying to keep your insulin dose to a minimum. Yeah, you want to control blood sugar, but just as in type 2 diabetics who suffer from too much insulin, but insulin resistance, even in a type 1 diabetic, you want to keep insulin requirements to a minimum, and you can do that via diet and exercise.
Oh, when a type 1 goes on a low-carb diet, we usually have to cut their basals in half. They need a lot less meal insulin. And what's beneficial also with the type 2s, when you're insulin resistant, we talk about the body. But in the mind, you know, insulin is one of many hormones that or substances that tell us we're full. And if you're insulin resistant, you just may not be getting those signals, and people's appetites are higher. And it's not that they don't have willpower. It's just that the body just can't say, I'm done. And when in a week on a low-carb diet, these people come back, I'm not that hungry. This diet is easy. Because even in a week, they can recalibrate their appetite. their energy. It's really significant.
But, you know, it's not that easy for some people. It's like turning around
right.
the Titanic, because they have a very serious momentum towards obesity, fatigue, depression, low levels of hormones, which exacerbate the problem. And it's a very complex issue. It's both psychological and physiological. The craving for sugar becomes overwhelming, and people become progressively apathetic, lethargic, and that's how a lot of people can't turn it around.
Well, I'll tell you what, Ron, another reason they can't turn it around is because in standard care, they have an 8-minute office visit.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they're told by some innovative doc, oh, do low carb. How do I even do that? With yep. integrative physicians, right, when we're spending an hour, 2 hours with patients and we have handouts and we've got all these resources. And the key with low carb is that, yeah, you can't eat grains, you can't eat potatoes. But you know what? Here's all this other stuff you can do with nuts and nut flours, and you can have breads and muffins and granola. And when people learn that actually their diet doesn't have to change that much, it's the constituents mm-hmm. from which they're eating these things, and they have the time with the physician to learn how to do this, it makes a huge difference for compliance.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And, you know, we've both seen miracles, but I've seen patients who I initially had some doubts over whether they could comply or whether they could even turn things around with hemoglobin A1Cs, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12,
yes.
who managed to, over several months, managed to normalize their blood sugar through strict
yeah.
compliance, through the right type of
right.
diet, exercise, supplementation, of course, we'll talk about in part two. This is a good point at which to pause, because we divide our podcast into two parts, and we've talked a little bit about diet. We'll talk about some other aspects of lifestyle, but also hone in on supplements, because supplements may play a role in optimizing blood sugar control for diabetics. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today with Dr. Mona Morstein. She's a naturopathic physician who's written a great book, Master Your Diabetes, just out, a comprehensive integrative approach for both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And we'll continue our discussion in just a moment here on Intelligent Medicine.